It was a real hell of a impact, but I did have the wherewithal to get out of my car because I realized I was sitting in the interstate with no lights on because it was completely black now. And when I got out of the car, it was when I realized it was a truck that I had hit. My dash cam really shows a really
Oh,
horrific.
wow. Thank you for tuning in to the Critical Conversations podcast, brought to you by Mind the Frontline. Established in 2023 as a 501c3, Mind the Frontline is your ally in the journey to support those who selflessly safeguard our communities. Their core mission revolves around pioneering innovation in research, education, and overall well-being, specifically tailored to healthcare, military, and public service frontline first responders. The Critical Conversation podcast is a dedicated space for police, fire, EMS, allied health workers, dispatchers, air medical, and military personnel, along with their families. Here, we dive into the heart of the matter, tackling essential topics such as mental health strategies, recovery methods, treatment options, the latest research, and professional development opportunities. Before we dive into today's episode on Critical Conversations, we do want to, however, acknowledge the nature of our discussions. Some of the content discussed may be triggering or intense as we explore the challenges and the triumphs within the first responder community. We recognize that these discussions may evoke strong emotions or memories. If you or someone you know is struggling and needs immediate support, we urge you to reach out to your agency's mental health resources or your local peer support group. In time of mental health crisis, you can always contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline by phone or via text at 988. Please remember, you are never alone and help is always available. At Mind the Frontline, we are more than just a podcast. We are a community committed to fostering resilience within the entire first responder family. So whether you're on the front lines or supporting those who are, we invite you to subscribe, engage, and be a part of this vital mission. To learn more, please visit us at www.mindthefrontline.org. Now let's dive into today's critical conversation. Welcome, first responders, listeners, and Mind the Frontline members. We welcome you back to another episode of Critical Conversations by Mind the Frontline, the podcast that stands with you at the front line of first responder mental health and wellness and recovery. I'm your host, Chris Matana. I'm a former firefighter and flight paramedic and also president of the Mind the Frontline organization. And I'm thrilled to have you guys join us today on today's episode as we talk a little bit about transitioning from the military to the EMS and learning a little bit more about just kind of what we might feel, some of those emotions and things like that. So I really have a great guest for you guys today, and I'm really excited to kind of not only hear his story, but share that with you so we can all kind of take away something. We have an incredible episode lined out. It does feature a fellow first responder, even though he is an air medical pilot. I still consider him first responders, and there really isn't a lot of organizations or resources out there for mental health and wellness. They're kind of out there on their own. So it's exciting to have Don Spells with us today. He's a former military pilot. He now is serving in HEMS. He's flying Part 91 right now, but he's got years and years of experience flying 135. And he's got over 45 years of helicopter experience with over 10,000 hours. Holy cow, if you don't know that is a lot of hours, folks. But 10,000 hours on both the Hilo and the fixed wing with over 37 years in HEMS and 40 plus years going with the Army National Guard and the Reserves. So let's introduce Don to the show. Don, go ahead and share a little bit about you, why you wanted to come on the show, what kind of piqued your interest about Mind the Front Lines and the Critical Conversation podcast, and what can our viewers and listeners kind of, you know, hear to kind of get to know you a little bit more.
Well, thank you, Chris, for having me on. I appreciate you taking the time. For myself, I went into the Army in 1974, right out of high school. I spent the summer kind of kicking around after graduating. And at that time, they were showing commercials on TV for flight school or high school to flight school. And it was to go straight into the Army, go to flight school, and become a warrant officer. And that really appealed to me. I'd always wanted to be a helicopter pilot and just to fly. So that's what I did. And had a little sidetrack, became a helicopter mechanic first. And it took time to go get through all that necessary paperwork and all the things you have to do to go to flight school. But I made it in late summer of 76 and graduated in 77. Went straight to Korea. Did a one-year stint there as a started out as a Huey pilot, but immediately transitioned to OH-58 and became a scout pilot, which, as it turns out, was very, very helpful for me as I went through my military career. And then I had a lot of experience in lighter aircraft that were used in EMS, as it turns out. So I spent 7.5 years or so on active duty. I left active duty and went to work with petroleum helicopters down in the Gulf of Mexico, flying 206s and the AS-350D A-STAR. Did that for about 3 years. Went to flight school again as an Army reservist for the Cobra course, which I flew the Cobra in training, but never flew it after that. That's when I actually applied. After I got through with that, I applied for a local position, EMS position here in Tallahassee. I was living up in South Georgia at the time where I grew up. And in 1985, I became an EMS pilot. And flying 206 L1s and with a 206 B3 as a backup. And if you can think about those days, I know the older pilots will understand that when most of the aircraft at the time in civilian world had a wet compass and an ADF, and that's basically all we had in the aircraft we were flying at the time. So I did that, and I stayed in the military. And I think that's where the crux of the show is how that transition from military to EMS, how that went about and what it really kind of takes to, you know, to really thrive in the EMS environment coming from the military. There's some things that you have to kind of adapt to, but the great thing about in my position in the military, being a scout pilot, a lot of the training and a lot of the actual flying that I did in the military as a scout pilot really transferred over into EMS and flying in the HEMS world. That skill set you take from the military into the civilian world it was highly transferable based on those types of flights that we did as scout pilots into the EMS world. It's very, very similar. If you took all the list of maneuvers that you would do as a scout pilot, you did some of the very exact same stuff you do in HEMS pilot. And I think that was the biggest thing that was really helpful for me to have the skill set going into it. In the military at the time that I was flying, we primarily flew single pilot. And that's all you typically do in the EMS world, a single pilot. Nowadays, in the military, you have two pilots, and you have a pilot or a co-pilot or an air mission commander and a pilot. But once you get in the HEMS, it's all you. And you really have to take that the idea that you're a professional pilot and this is what you do to heart, because it's all you up in the front of the aircraft. And
I could kind of relate to that as like when I became a paramedic, you know, it's like, it's all you now, you know, it's like, oh, right. Shoot, I got to step into the big boy's shoes. I don't have, you know, my paramedic to look up to or anything like that. And right. I just want to point out, Don, that you've mentioned three aircraft that are among one of my, you know, my favorite, my, almost my top three. They're definitely the three of the top five, but the Huey, the OH-58, especially the Kiowa version of it. And looking at the Cobra. I mean, that's an old workhorse from back in the days, but that thing is sick, especially the Zulu model I used to be around when I was down in Yuma.
Yeah, I flew the S model in training. And so we had the tow missiles and the helmet sighted three barrel 20 millimeter cannon on the front of the aircraft. So it was respectable at the time.
Yeah, that Vulcan can would really wake you up.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, talk to me a little bit about, like, you know, you talk about, you know, the transition, you know, how does it feel or what was it like kind of navigating dual identities, because you kind of stayed around in the reserves afterwards as you were still a HEAMS pilot, and you're kind of in and out of both sides of the civilian world and the mil world. You know, and you mentioned a lot during your intro, just kind of talking about, you know, what you did as a scout pilot, you know, flying the OH-58, you know, how that transitioned over into the civilian world. You know, if you want to talk a little bit about, you know, what was that like, you know, that initial transition, especially too.
Yeah, that, well, you know, the one thing that I was kind of positioning myself in the military, I was always had in mind that I was not going to spend 20 years in the military and then get out. I always knew that I was going to do this till I got the skill set that I felt I needed, and I could get out of the military and go into a civilian job. And at the time, EMS was still kind of new. Back in those days. But I looked at it.
Now, when you say back in those days, let's put a date on this.
Yeah, this is
for a lot of these people that don't even understand like when HIMSS even started, you know, and yeah, what the first HIMSS program was maybe.
Yeah. Well, HIMSS has been around for a while. I left active duty in 1981, and you know, there was always already rumblings about, you know, military guys going to civilian jobs. And I ran into a couple of people when I went to PHI when I first got out, and who I'd been in the Army with. And there was already the talk of EMS. And during that time period, you know, it was, okay, I've got a skill set that's in the military, and I had stayed in the Army Reserves as in the Individual Ready Reserve at that time. And so I did my annual training, a 19-day period annually, obviously. And I would get to fly usually the UH-1 because they didn't have a lot of at the time when I first got out, that you could select a unit you would desire to go to. If they would accept you, you could go to that unit and fly. And so I just typically ended up going to Fort Rucker and flying to Huey for that 19-day period. So I kept myself in that military mix the entire time I flew EMS. And it was a slow slog through, you know, getting enough points to make a good year as a reservist at the time. And so, you know, it was a little difficult to get those good years. And that's why I spent over 40 years in the Army, was I never got out. It was all 40 years of continuous service, but it just took time to get through that. But it always kept me in that military mindset. But the one thing you have to drop pretty quickly when you go into the EMS world, particularly flying HEAMS, is that in the military, you're always thinking about getting the mission done, whatever it took to do the mission. At whatever cost. And, you know, back in those days, I'm not terribly sure about it now, but back in those days, the commander of the unit could tell you what your minimums were. And they sometimes didn't have to match what the regulations said. So it was that mindset of the mission must be complete. You start a mission, you finish the mission. And the pilot in command is the final authority. And if you decide, you go, everybody goes. That was back in those days. Mm-hmm. In the HEAMS world, you have to kind of leave that behind because you've got a crew that is part of your crew, and they're part of the decision-making, the OODA loop that you use to, hey, we're going to go do this. Well, it's three to go and one to stay. It's a very famous term. That in the early days of EMS, you never heard that, but
have good crew resource management in the early days, or you know, some of these more focused safety programs like AMRAAM. Exactly. You know, AMRAAM. What's AMRAAM? I don't even understand what AMRAAM is. You know, that's where the three to one, three to go, one to say no came out of, and you know, I've had my share of pilots, especially new to transitioning that came directly out of the military, especially flying like you know, the Arizona, you know, river, Northern Arizona, we got a lot of the pilots that came out of, you know, Yuma and some of the YPG, you know, things like that. And, you know, one of the things that I would notice is exactly what you kind of said, is some of them have this mentality of, you know, we got to go. And, you know, me as a now educated crew member, because there's many times I wasn't, especially early on. And when I was still wet behind the ears, or very wet, because I, you know, I always say you're wet behind the ears. You never can learn too much, but I'd find these individuals, they would come out and they just wanted, you know, you look outside and go, dude, we're not going to go fly in that. Are you kidding me? Like, I'm not getting in that aircraft. And I remember the first time I said that to this, he was a lieutenant colonel that just rotated out. Me telling him that we weren't going to take the mission, you know, you could just see the gas just get poured on the fire. Cause he was just like, wait, what? I said, get in the aircraft, boy, you know, and we had to have a little conversation about, hey, what am I comfortable with? Because maybe, you know, you're used to it, you know, in the military world, in a, there's that power command structure. There's a lot of, you know, not only liability, but just decision-making processes that happen solely based on the pilot in command, and everybody kind of follows that leadership. And it's a little bit of a different kind of structure when you get into the civilian, HEMS world or air medical in general, you know? And so, you know, I've seen some of those struggles for some of the newer people that transition out. I've actually seen it get better. Actually, the longer that I was actually in air medical, is because I think you started seeing a little bit of the transition from civilian aviation, at least the regs and requirements and policies, kind of transition a little bit over to the military side. So it wasn't such a completely different world. I mean, really, it was almost like, you know, this gentleman who's used to Earth now laying on the moon. And yeah, you feel like you can fly. A helicopter is a helicopter is a helicopter, but it's not the same kind of helicopter. It's not the same duck quack, so to speak, you know?
Right. Well, you know, in the early days of my flying in EMS, we had no written minimums for weather. They were not written down. And we were basically looking at what did the Part 135 regulations say, or Part 91. And as long as you live with those and, you know, go, no one said anything to you. In 1986, I think it was the year that we had a rash of about, a huge number of IFR-related crashes where 24 or 25 people were killed in that one year. And the FAA got involved. And, you know, that's where you started seeing Part 135, 273, and all those about weather minimums and establishing written weather minimums came about. It really made a big difference in the EMS world when we have stuff that's written down. And okay, I'm not going to go fly. I'm below minimums, and that's just all there is to it. And you know, that saved a lot of people. Now, a lot of the things I think nowadays that's saving people is that we have new technology that's coming into the helicopter world, better equipment, more equipment to give you that spatial awareness that you need in EMS, because you know, out flying at 3 o'clock in the morning and weather that, you know, you get a taste of seat cushion in your mouth when you're flying in it, and then but you're still legal. But you have situational awareness now that we didn't have back in the day. You know, with the advent of more and more.
Taste your seat cushions. That's a good one. I've never heard that one, Don.
that's an old Army term. But even today, even with the minimums, there are times when if you're non-NVG, which the day I flew NVG for the first time in helicopters in EMS was a game changer for me. I swore I would never go back to flying unaided
non-unaided
EMS. Yeah, that's
and I came in 2008, and I've always had NVGs, but when we went from the green to the white FOSS, you know, goggles, man, it was just like an eye opener. Well, you're like, holy cow, I can't even believe I was flying with green all these layers, like let alone like, oh man, I don't know what flying unaided is like, but I can tell you there's times like where I've had a goggle failure or the pilot's had a goggle failure and I have to go, hey, here are my goggles, you know, and I'm sitting up front just like staring off in the black and I'm like, I can taste my seat cushion now. it's kind of chewy.
That is a real thing. Yeah. Yeah. I've never flown white phosphorus goggles. I've only had the Anbus 9s is the best I've ever had. But even those are just, it's something I don't think will ever go back to unaided night. And, you know, the advent of more and more helicopters with autopilots is a good thing. I'd like to see every EMS helicopter with a save me Jesus button on their cyclic. And, you know, that's made a big difference. But, you know, the big thing, though, for a military guy, the one thing I wanted to bring up is that in the military, those guys are still in the military. And even if you're just starting out your military career, if it's not something that you think you're going to continue on for 20 years, is always look for that opportunity to get flight time, get experience. And, you know, the lighter aircraft, you know, and I know the military is changing, you know, a lot of the way they do things and stuff. And the scout pilot is still there. And, you know, the lighter aircraft, and it doesn't even have to be lighter aircraft, any aircraft that you can get enough flight time to meet the minimums of companies that are doing HEMS in the world. You just always look for that opportunity to get that experience and a wide variety of experience. So when you go to a HEMS provider and you say, hey, I'd like to work for you, you send them a resume, you know, you're going to have the stuff that they're looking for. And most of them are night vision goggle flying companies. So, you know, all that time you're going to have in there, if you can get some of the unaided in there as well, because that kind of still is appropriate at times, but not in the EMS, but for my feeling. But when you go to, you know, to a company and say, I want to fly EMS, you can expect that you're going to get good training. My company that I work for, Air Methods, I'll use mostly all level D simulators for most of their training. And, you know, they're top notch. Most of the aircraft that we operate in the company have a level D simulator that they teach on. And then you get time in the actual aircraft during a transition, because you'll go through a full transition in that level D, and then you'll go fly the real aircraft. And then when you get to your base, you're going to, you know, be the guy that's flying day shift till you get kind of used to the area. But you're expected from day one, your first EMS flight, you're the PIC. And, you know, you have a crew, it's three to go, one to stay. If you keep that mindset, that's just how this system works. It's an easy transition. But the biggest thing is that, you know, you're a professional and they're going to expect a professional level activity from you. And it'll be a good thing. I have nothing but good memories of my flying in EMS. You know, it was a tremendous amount of experience, and I saw a lot of good things that people can do for other people in the EMS environment. And I wouldn't trade it for anything.
I'm right there with you. You know, I've always wanted, except I've wanted to trade seats, like instead of flying in the back and treating the patient or up front, aiding the pilot, like I want to fly. So, you know, I think you get that bug, and there's times where we want to switch places. Some of my favorite pilots have always been kind of the Kiowa pilots, because you brought up Scout and things like that. But some of those guys, man, like I had a pilot named Chris Moore that helped me start up the Oregon lifeguard bases up there in Grants Pass and Tillamook. And the guy just was cool as a cucumber. He knew how to control that aircraft almost completely blind if he had to. Like, he just was, getting him in that aircraft, he was just one. He was the stick, he was the cyclic, you know.
Right.
You know, great people. And I've been a part of a lot of new pilots, to EMS, you know, whether they came from the fixed wing side, the civilian side, tour operators, flying the Gulf. You know, I've been there on their first day and helped them as a crew member to kind of navigate it, you know, really kind of doing the pre-plan, kind of trying to keep, because I come from the public safety world, you know, and so, right. You know, as a firefighter, you know, every day there's stuff that has to go on, you know, at certain times or there's certain requirements. And so we kind of had a routine. And so by creating kind of a routine on shift, I found that it really aided in their transition because, hey, in the morning, we're going to do this. We're going to get together as a team. We're going to go out and pre-flight the aircraft, make sure there's no FODs, you know, on the LZ, you know, all this stuff. And it kind of gave them a sense of almost normalcy or balance, I would say. And then even when the first tone drop or the first text comes through for a flight, you know, it's like, hey, I'm going to help you work through it. You know, I'm going to help right. be a resource, you know, and right. I've had really good pilots come through. There are those lone wolves, I call them, that come in with the ego of, once again, I'm pilot in command, you sit in the back, you shut up, you hold on. And that pilot usually has a lot of friction ahead of them. And I don't see that transition being as easy as it probably could. Right, some other things right. that you mentioned that I wanted to just kind of touch bases on, especially for our non-aviation first responders that might be listening to this, or, you know, just any of the viewers, when he's mentioning a Class D simulator, those are one of the highest flight simulators you can train or practice in or do your recurrent training, because it's a high, you know, basically a high fidelity simulator, meaning that, correct. You know, it feels like you're taking off. It feels like you're going up and down, and it's very interactive, and it almost feels as close as we can get to the real thing. So I just wanted to kind of put it out there because I know Air Methods. I used to formerly fly with them as a flight medic in Arizona. And so I do know that they invest a lot of money into safety and training and things right. like that. And that is typically what you would find in a lot of the larger air medical companies if they're looking to transition out. The other thing, you know, bringing up is the amount of hours. Don, do you off the top of your head know what are companies looking for as far as minimum hours, PIC, total flight, things like that, as far as the requirements? I can reference the CAMES requirements, obviously, and that's maybe a starting point, but I just wanted to see if you knew something off the top of your head.
No, I do know that all companies have had to lower the total.
They have. I was going to bring that up.
Requirements, because the military has traditionally been the feeder for all EMS companies.
And now they're staying in longer.
They're staying in longer, and unfortunately, they're not getting the amount of flight time that, you know, we used to get in the military. I think I left the military with about 1,700 hours when I went to work for PHI, and, you know, I picked up quite a bit of time there. So when I showed up for EMS flying, I had a lot of time under my belt, and it just happened to be in the aircraft that, you know, I'd been flying in the military and at PHI. Boom, I dropped right into a position, and off I went. But, you know, I don't know the exact number, but of course you can pull up any of the major operators, or any of the operators have a website and look at the career page, and you'll see what their minimums are. You're going to see, I would not be surprised to see 1,500 total hours and, you know, required total time. And then they obviously want some turbine time as well. That's where you see a lot of civilian pilots that's coming on board EMS now. And, you know, even those who have quite a bit of instructor time or flying, even crop dusters, we've seen crop dusters come through before that had lots of time in crop dusters. But, you know, some of it, you know, they're going to require turbine time.
Yeah.
So
I know the CAMES requirements when it comes to, at least, you know, I could kind of pull off the top of my head the helicopter requirements for a helicopter HEMS pilot, but, you know, it used to be 3,000 hours, and it's come down over the years. You know, I remember when I first came in, it was 3,000 hours, and that was hard to get for a lot of people, but man, those pilots were experienced, right? And I saw over the years as I continued as a flight mech, and I saw the requirement of hours come down, you know, to 2,500, and I believe it's at 2,000 or right around there right now for, you know, total hours. And then piloting a command, you know, they're looking at anywhere from 500, 100 to 500 or so, and then obviously turbine time.
That's a hard thing for military guys now, is getting the pilot and command time. You know,
the PIC.
There. If you're the PIC, you're building the time, but you know, if you're over there as the, you know, it's just the thing that you have to, you've got to look for that opportunity to get the experience that you're going to need in the civilian world. So
if you're a new guy, new pilot out there, especially on the military side, you know, start taking a look at some of these larger organizations now and seeing where you can at least start putting your goal so you can track that way, you know, over your career. You know, hey, if I got to put in 7 good years, but when I get done with my 7 years, I can roll out, you know, to IRR and also go over to, you know, you set yourself up for success and being able to transition into a civilian life and being able to make good money, you know, and things like that and stability.
Well, you know, I recommend to anyone who's going to get out of the military, stay in the military as a reservist or National Guard and get the time that you need. All companies support the military. You know, Air Methods is great about that. And, you know, they allowed me to, you know, to stay in the military and get, you know, eventually get retirement out of it. And that's an important thing.
So when you talk about the transition out, the next thing I want to talk about or shift to is cultural shifts. You know, what is the different, you know, you got on the military side, sometimes people would imagine it to be very precise. I've heard it be very precise, but I've heard it very loosey-goosey, like you mentioned, like regs change on the fly, minimums go down or disappear all of a sudden. But when we examine the contrast and the difference of culture between the military, which is known for more of its precision and structure, and the dynamic of a fast-paced environment over of HIMSS, you know, what are some of those adjustments that, and some strategies that you might have for those aspiring gentlemen or females, you know, those aspiring new pilots that might want to transition over to the civilian side from the military side?
Well, I mean, in the military, you're controlled basically by regulation. And, you know, you, as a pilot in the military, you got to know the regulation. You operate within those regulation. It's no different in the civilian world. All companies have operators manual, operations manuals, and they're chock full of policies and procedures that you must follow as you're doing your job day to day. So hour for hour. And not unlike the military, the civilian side have risk assessments that you have to go through. And, you know, they're pretty tight nowadays, particularly after 9/11, when, you know, the requirement for operational control centers and you pretty much don't fly unless somebody's watching you somewhere and keeping track of you and stuff. So that... the type of flying you do in the military under those regulations is not much different than what the regulations and policies and procedures you have to do as a civilian pilot as well. So that transition, I think, is easy. It's just being able to live within that HEAMS world where you're not the final say, per se. The FAA recognizes you as the pilot in command having final authority, but that's to stop a flight. You can't begin a flight unless you have all three on board that's okay with
it. Say, hey, I feel comfortable. Let's go do this. And sometimes I call them the fourth guy, you know, the fourth person back in OCC because they can, you can be like, hey, yeah, let's go do this. And all of a sudden, like your flight gets canceled. It's because OCC, you know, turned it down for you, you know, and those are good things. I mean, that's how we cover our bases. You know, I like that.
Yeah. I had two occasions where OCC canceled a flight on and, okay, they weren't seeing what I was seeing, but they're authority in it, so they can do that.
And I've been there too on that side where I complain. Yeah, you know, it's like they cancel as we get back. We're like, do they not even see? There's nothing, you know. But and that's just my reaction initially, especially, you know, being a young kind of alpha male flight medic, you know. But what I've learned with the experience is I've learned to appreciate it a lot because I've also seen a lot of the safety. Implementations that have happened over these years since I've been in this, which is almost 20 years, you know, seeing those safety changes has absolutely saved lives and continues to do so. And so my reactions right now, as I've gotten older, are not the same. It's more like, oh, hey, thank you, OCC, for having my back. I might even send the guy an email just to let him know how much I appreciate it because it's kind of like an unsung job. But, you know, they're basically looking after you to make sure that you all go home, you know, and sometimes they may not see everything, but you know, I know there's times when you absolutely do need them and you're very, very thankful to have them there. And so a good little friendly reminder. What was some of, like, when you talk about cultural shifts, like what were some of the mental adjustments or strategies that you had to adapt successfully to transition out? You know, I hear people, you know, the cultures are very similar when you move from, I think, military to the public safety world, HIMSS, things like that. There are some parallels, obviously some differences. But at the same time, I also, like, I've heard of people struggling with, you know, just identity and some of the other little nuances that come with leaving behind something that you were familiar with and kind of moving to something that is a little bit different. Have you experienced that personally, or, you know, do you have any tips or tricks for those listening?
Well, there were times when, you know, you kind of missed the camaraderie you had in the military settings. And, but you know, you get some of that, not on the bigger scale, like in the military where you were in a unit and you knew everyone and you were always together in some capacity, but in HIMSS, you're usually three of you, on shift. And, you know, you still have some of that, but it's just a matter of, you know, forming the relationships and just having a good time with it and stay safe.
That was one of the biggest things I think I missed when I was working DOD and fire, especially, is just that camaraderie, you know, being able to be with people every day, your crew. You know, you don't have that as much at some of the bases, but what I found is I tried to create that kind of same kind of feel at some of the bases I was at, you know, by cooking together, hanging out, watching crew TV together, doing, you know, if the pilot's out, you know, scrubbing down the helicopter, guess who's going to be out there with them or her, you know, myself and my crew. Like, we try to do things together to really kind of build that camaraderie, because there's times where things get really, really stressful. And you gotta need to be able to lean on each other, you know, whether it be a stressful situation or, you know, we all go through life. You know, there's days when I would come on shift and I, you know, would not be at the full mental capacity or emotional capacity that I need to, because life was kind of really bearing down on me. And so having that kind of togetherness, you know, is something that you can create. It may not be the exact same. This is where I think shifting your perspective and your expectations, more importantly, you know, you can still have the same results. They're just in a different kind of flavor, so to speak. You mentioned a little bit about your story before we hopped on. So I kind of want to, you know, share this with the viewers, if that's okay. But, you know, when you talk about embracing the unpredictable, you've been there, you know, you've been there as far as some of those struggles, and I don't want to give it away, but Don, do you mind kind of sharing, you know, some of the mental resiliency you had to go through your career, especially towards the latter part of it, because that's something that, while it's unexpected, you know, I think there is some light to both sides of your story, and I'd really like it to share if possible.
Yeah, sure. Well, I told you earlier that I had decided to retire from active EMS flying this past July, a year ago, in 22. And so I did, and remained on with Air Methods as a Part 91 pilot to move aircraft within the Southeast or wherever they needed. So that's what I typically did for that year. However, on July 30th, this past year, it was 5:30 in the morning. I'd left my house early to go to Panama City to go fishing on the last day of red snapper season. And got on the interstate, and as I passed the Quincy exit heading west, I impacted a drunk driver who was asleep at the wheel, parked in my lane. I hit him at 70 miles an hour. I was not knocked unconscious. I remained conscious. It was a real hell of a impact, but I did have the wherewithal to get out of my car, because I realized I was sitting in the interstate with no lights on because it was completely black now. And when I got out of the car, this is when I realized it was a truck that I had hit. My dash cam really shows a really horrific thing. And but I did sustain some injuries that when I got to the hospital, you know, went through a lot of CTs, and fortunately, I only had to stay in the hospital for about 28 hours or so, something like that. But as I was departing the hospital to come home to recover, the trauma surgeon said, listen, we found some things on your CT when we CT'd your body, and we need you to probably go see a cardiologist at your earliest convenience. So it took a little while to get the referral, and I went to see the cardiologist, and he immediately said, let's go to catheterization.
Let's go right to the cath lab.
Go straight to the cath lab. If we find anything, we'll pop a stent in there, and off you'll go. But unfortunately, he found a 95% occlusion of my left coronary artery, and said, you need open heart surgery. As a pilot, that was devastating news to me, because I knew exactly that I knew that the wreck itself required some time off, but this was going to be permanent. And so I did go through open heart surgery. I had a triple bypass and survived that as well, and left the hospital 4 days later and came home. And that was, you know, about 3 months ago, 3 or 4 months ago. So as it turns out, that encounter with a drunk driver nearly killed me, but it kind of saved my life, because I probably wouldn't have known that I had this condition, that I didn't have any symptoms prior to that. And so
you were completely asymptomatic, no shortness of breath with activity, no, nothing like that.
I just thought of myself as being really out of shape. But as the doctor told me later after the surgery, the cardiologist said, you would not have survived a stress test. So, his decision to go straight to cath. There's a path back. If you read the regulations, the FAA regulations, in 6 months after surgery for open heart surgery and a CABG that I did have, there is a path back, but it's can be very expensive, and it's not without danger just to get that the test that's required by the FAA. But I kind of look back on it as I survived it all, and I had a good career, and had a great time, and I can't complain about it. I look at it as something that allows me to live, so I feel good about it.
I love how you're able to pull some of the positivity out of that, Don, because you look behind me, like my vest and my flight helmet are on the rack, and they've been up there for the last 3.5 years. And that transition out of, clinical work, being on the front line, things like that, I still feel like I want to jump back on right now. Like if there was a 407 out there and then you had to go on a scene flight, like get out of my way. I'm grabbing my helmet and I'm gone, and I just can't do that anymore, with my own mental health and putting that first for myself. I can somewhat empathize in some of that identity, and it's like and I didn't have the option at first. I eventually gained it back after 2 years of really intensive back therapy, but I had a really horrific back injury on the job that pretty much almost put me out, even I remember the physician, and this is what scared the shit out of me. And I can only kind of relate a little bit to when you hearing the news of, I need to go have open heart surgery. Cause you know exactly what that means as a pilot, what that's going to do to your medical card. It's going to get pulled and punched right away. Right. As soon as I had that back injury and I had a physician come in and they told me, like, Chris, we don't think you're ever going to be able to practice, being a paramedic again, picking up patients, just what the job requires, like your back, there might not be a way back, And I took no as a try harder, and I did. And I found that way back only to eventually hang it up on my terms, meaning that, my previous business IA Med had gotten very successful and it needed more of my time. So that's a good thing, I guess, but I was able to go out on my terms, not having it on your terms. I can only imagine some of the struggles that you might kind of balance.
It's a daily thing I think about, but it's really, I have to kind of balance that with, I came through some pretty tough things and made it through, and,
And I'm sure you touched a lot of people and saved a lot of lives, Don, on the way here. And that doesn't just go away. You know, those memories that we have, those really impactful flights and differences we made on those one time, you know, I have 100 flights that were just, you know, they were great flights, scenic, you know, great time. But there are a handful of flights that I know without a doubt the impact that I left behind on that, right, that family, that community, whatever it might be, and bringing closure, you know. And yeah, so I do hope that you do, you know, find that peace. And it sounds like, you know, just like all of us, like me in my recovery, you know, it is a day-to-day thing. You know, what are some day-to-day things that you have a part of your routine now that you really didn't have, you know, maybe a year ago? What are you doing to help with that mental resiliency, to help you kind of move forward versus what you were doing when you were actually flying?
Well, I'm spending more time, obviously, at home. I recently had a party with some of the crew I was working with when I retired. And I made the comment that it's an amazing feeling to sleep in my bed every single night and not
right
in some bed in a base somewhere or in a hotel or things like that. But, you know, regardless of when you retire, your honeydew list does not get shorter. So, I mean, I stay pretty busy.
That's the funny thing. It's like, how did I do all this stuff when I actually had a job? And then like, it's like, you find right yourself, you know, with extra time on your hand, you're like, I seem like I can't get anything done. And all you're doing is just honeydew stuff all day.
Right. Well, you know, I have my hobbies. You know, I do a great deal of work down in my shop. I have a shop full of projects, and I do a lot of different things as hobbies. So, you know, those days are filled pretty much. And I have a 3-year-old granddaughter that I spend quite a bit of time with as well. You know, I think about that. You know, the fact that I'm still playing with my granddaughter is an amazing thing. After this past summer, the summer of 23 will be very memorable.
I'm sure, you know, in good ways and bad ways. You know, I'm glad because I do know the stats, you know, being a flight clinician and a critical care medic, you know, 95% occlusion of your left main is, you're knocking on what we call, that's the widowmaker, right?
That's
that we
the talk widowmaker.
About. Like, exactly when everybody talks about like the widow, you had the widowmaker, it just hadn't gotten, I mean, all it would have been maybe a percent or two more, or you just overexerting yourself in one little instance, and that would have taken you out of the fight and you wouldn't be here. So,
right.
You know, I shared a story with you, but I didn't really share it necessarily with my viewers, but someone else that kind of remind me of in the resiliency and what you went through. You know, I had a good friend of mine, a former instructor, you know, Dylan, he had fallen down after trying to put up Christmas lights, fallen off his ladder, fractured his legs, you know, he got life-flighted, you know, all of this. And, you know, it was very overwhelming for him. You know, the initial thought of recovery, the damage, I'm laid up in a hospital for almost 30 days, not able to move, you know, all this stuff. But when he was in there, same thing, you know, they're doing all these CTs, they're looking at everything, making sure there's no bleeds. And what they found was a mass on one of his kidneys, and they had to remove that kidney, and they were able to stop the, I believe the little tumor, and I don't want to give too much away, but I think everybody kind of knows Dylan's story if you haven't followed me for a while, but they were able to save the other one and effectively save his life. And, you know, I remember the conversations I had with Dylan on the phone while he was laid up in the hospital, just trying to keep his spirits up and really trying to point out like, well, look at the little things, you know, he had a newborn daughter, you got a 3-year-old right granddaughter, you know, it's like, you wouldn't have these things without these challenges. And sometimes, you know, the universe puts challenges in our ways and we may not understand them, and they may be overwhelming, you know, and having those routines, having those hobbies that you mentioned, you know, recognizing some of the small wins that we get every day and we can appreciate. I'm like you, I don't get the jump around from hotel to hotel, airline to airline. My frequent flyer status is going down. And you know what? I'm okay with that because I get to be home with my kids, and I'm making up for all the lost time that I didn't even realize I lost until you actually have it and you start looking in that light. So,
right,
you know, your story is absolutely inspiring, Don. What are some of the things that you like to do, I think, you know, as far as skills wise, that you feel like set yourself up? Let me kind of rephrase that. When you were early on in your military career, when you look at your skills, what the military brought you, you know, how did you see some of those skills transferring on, and what skills did you feel like, hey, I wish I would have picked these up earlier or had these when I came into civilian, you know, air medical or HIMSS flying?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of the training that you receive as a military pilot, you know, you're doing certain maneuvers that, you know, required by the position you're flying or the type of mission you're going to be flying with the aircraft. And it can be very aircraft specific as well. You know, you just are gaining those skills that you will put to play in a civilian job almost immediately. And it will be the exact same thing you're going to do that you have been doing in the military. You're going to do that in the civilian world. And you will be amazed at just the kind of stuff you'll do. And the HEAMS environment is very, very, very reminiscent of military operations that you do. You know, the one thing about the military is you're always training, and short of actually going to the desert and going into combat, you know, you're training. But in the HEAMS world, it's real. Everything about what you're doing is real. You're going to make a difference in somebody's life, usually. And, you know, the things that you learned as a military pilot really transfer right over into the EMS world and HEAMS operations. And you'll use those skills and those techniques that you learned, and you'll use them every single day. Everything that you do in the HEAMS world, you've used in the military, and that's where you learned it. And, you know, all that skill that you acquired directly transfers right over into the civilian line as well.
And it seems like there's a lot of good crossover. And, you know, it's a very similar place to land when you're talking about, you know, transition. And that kind of leads me into the next topic is, I've heard about a lot, because obviously I've never served. You know, I was a Department of Defense contractor, so I don't have the same experience, nor did I have the opportunity to serve my country like you did. But what I've heard from a lot of, you know, members active duty that are rotated out is really trying to find some sort of support network. And it sounds like you kind of had that, you know, maybe you didn't realize it, but, you know, in when you were transitioning out, already having some buddies that you were already in your unit that already gone to work at PHI, that kind of, and I've seen something very similar here where it's, you'll get a couple guys together and all of a sudden you notice, you know, we did that with Tillamook, you know, cause we got a lot of coasties up there, and those guys, I was all for, except I had to remind them that, you know, you guys typically fly out and scud run the water because there's nothing to run into. But here, right, we got mountains and trees and stuff. And yeah, so, you know, it's going to do some damage, boys. Like, let's not have a sea fit here. So, but we would find a lot of those gentlemen, and they would come over, and you'd usually kind of see them comes in 2Zs or 3Zs, you know, things like that. And so, you know, how would you recommend someone go about trying to find that supportive transition community to really kind of help them with their, you know, emotion, just all of this stuff that comes with it, you know, ensuring our mental health and well-being at the same time? I think it's lost, you know, because we're full of stress. There's a lot of life change, big life events. But what are some tools that can really kind of hopefully keep this to a minimum, allow people to kind of process things? You know, what are some of those things that you found?
Well, I one thing I found, I think that you, and I think other people will as well, is that once you go from military into the civilian world, you will be amazed at the number of people you already know probably working at your company. And, you know, particularly people that you've served with, there's going to be a lot of them that you served with in the company you actually work for. And so you have the ability to connect with those individuals. And, you know, nowadays, you know, with, you know, you have email and you've got FaceTime and you've got Facebook and, you know, all the social media connections that you can have, that's where that comes into play, is that keeping connected with the, you know, the people who are like-minded like yourself and in the same field, it helps to have, you know, that ability to bounce things off of one another and to kind of understand and see where other people are, what they're thinking about their job and how to get along and, you know, in the world that's different from the military. So, you know, having the ability to connect with one another is pretty important, you know, whether it be social media or just the fact that, you know, a lot of us, you know, have email contacts and phone numbers of people from years ago that's still in your mm-hmm. phone. You still have email. And, you know, using those for your advantage to be able to bounce things off of and to, you know, kind
leverage
of
leverage the network you've been building all these years and while you were in before you get out, huh? Funny right. how that yeah. works. Yeah. And I see
it's all about
posts,
networking.
You know.
It's all it is. About networking. You definitely have to keep networked. You know, it's always good to have somebody on the inside that you know that can give you some insight. And, you know, particularly for military guys, if you've already got friends in the EMS world, which I would almost believe that there are quite a few, use those contacts to, you know, to help you get along in your quest. So.
Yeah, I think I saw a warrant officer post not too long ago, you know, on, I think it was the flight paramedics group or something like that on Facebook. But he was basically like, hey, I got 3 years left, but I want to become a HIMSS pilot. Like, does anybody know any HIMSS pilot? You know, and you got to see, you know, these former, you know, active duty helicopter pilots jumped in. You know, so there is a community out there. It's always silent, you know, it's quiet right. in the background, but it's there right. when you need it. You know, some other resources I would recommend, like the National EMS Pilots Association, you know, NIMSPA, they have a great kind of organization there, and you'll probably end up looking them up and becoming a member, hopefully. But, you know, they have a lot of supportive resources, and they can at least, you know, should you not have any immediate contacts, at least point you to the right directions. And they probably got contacts within some of these organizations, so they can call and talk to with the chief pilot and kind of, hey, you know, what are you kind of looking for? What are you looking in? You know, what hours should I really be focused on to make myself a better candidate? And, you know, do you have any, you know, former or active, you know, active duty reserve, you know, pilots working for you that I could talk to? And I haven't found any organization out there yet. Classic, Tri-State Care Flight did this, PHI, I've seen Air Methods do it. You know, most of the organizations I've worked for have somebody there you'll probably right. know or have heard of, right? Like, just like you mentioned, Don, like, it's a small, small community on this side world. Of the fence. So you did, the likelihood you know someone is going to be relatively high, or at least they've heard your name. Which kind of transitions into my next thing and our kind of closing topic for today's show. But, you know, I look at your bio, Don, and you know, 45 years you're going, you know, I got to look at someone like you, and I have to ask the question, because I'm sure we all go through that. You know, the day-to-day struggles, feeling down, depressed, in the gunk, whatever you talk about, you know, but would you think of long-term resilience? You know, what are some of the lessons over 45 years that maybe you could pick from in a short, you know, couple of minutes that, or, you know, you're like, hey, these things kind of helped me learn. These were little lessons along the way that helped me learn how to deal with life, how to deal with stress, to maybe shift my perspective. You know, I'm having a crappy morning, but it doesn't mean I can't have a nice, beautiful afternoon or evening. You know, what you've been doing this for 45 years. I did this for 23, and I can tell you it almost mentally crushed me. And there's things that I wish I would have done better, and tools I would have had more of or learned sooner. What are some of those things that you could now pass on to the new guy, the junior warrant officer that is coming into the profession? He's a newer pilot, maybe 1 or 2 years under his belt, and he wants to get into this. You know, how did you make it 45 years, Don? Because that is inspiring, sir. The amount of hours and what you've done, I can only imagine the ripples in the pond of life that you've left.
Well, I tell you, you really have to keep an open mind to not take yourself too seriously. And, you know, you've got to look for the positive. If you can find it, always look for a positive in, you know, your situation. And, you know, just keep your focus on what it is you have as a goal in your life and what it is you want to achieve. And, you know, my goals were always to be as good as I possibly could at all times, because as an EMS pilot, you have to be 100% right every time. You have to have the same number of landings as you have takeoffs. That's just all there is to it. And so, you know, always looking for that opportunity to learn, because never think you know everything, and never thinking that you've got this aircraft figured out, because that's when the aircraft can show you something you never saw before. And always be that pilot. You know, we were taught in flight school that this helicopter is made by man, and things can break. The best things can break. And we were always taught that this thing is going to break at the most inopportune time, but you better be ready for it. So always having that in mind, that you're never the true master of this thing, and even your skills. I always kind of looked at it as my skills need to be refreshed every year. And that's why we do recurrent training. And it was something I looked forward to, because I always wanted to be a better pilot when I came out of that training process. And because our decision-making has to be 100%, there's very little room for, you know, a 99% of the time.
I don't want to fly with a 99% of time pilot, because I want to have, like you said, the same number of takeoffs. I want to have the equal number of landings, you know, and hopefully they're in a controlled fashion under our own kind of wishes.
Yeah.
No, that's really inspiring, Don. And I think it does. It shows that mental fortitude, you know, really, you know, ego, putting some of that stuff aside, really being kind of humble is what I heard. So you can have that wide perspective and receive the information that you see you need. But more importantly, you're able to have new information imparted upon you. You know, when you also look at just kind of what you've gone through in your 45 years, you know, transitioning from military to civilian, I'm sure a lot of the experiences you have along the way, you know, to what happened last year or last July, you know, there's a lot to unpack there. But, you know, 45 years, you know, I think you've shown at least me what mental resiliency has. And like you mentioned, we don't all have great days, but, you know, it's how we choose to attack the next day that defines who we are. And just getting back up, you know, that is the battle. You know, what happens after I take that next step is not up to me. I don't have any control over that, but I have a control whether I want to live or die, or if I want to take that next breath, or if I want to wake up and take that step in the morning. That I do have control over. And just reminding ourselves of really, truly how powerful we are as human beings and how special we are as first responders. I'm really, really tremendously grateful and honored to have you on the show, Don, to share your story, to hopefully inspire those new junior officers that want to come out of the military and transition their way into air medical transport, whether it be fixed wing or my favorite rotor wing all the time. But Dental, thank you very much for your time. Any last words you want to share with our viewers or our audience before we sign off for tonight?
Well, just go out there every day and do the right thing. Be as good as you can and always be willing to learn.
You heard it from Don Spells, ladies and gentlemen. You know, 45 years, you know, total is a pilot. The impact this gentleman has made both in air medical and in service to our country just cannot be measured in so many terms. So thank you very much for all of our viewers and listeners. As we conclude another insightful episode of Critical Conversations by Mind the Frontline, we would like to express our sincere appreciation to Don for sharing his just story, his valuable insights of transitioning from the military to the EMS and some of the mental challenges that we might, you know, hit along the way. His story and his depth of his knowledge really just further carried our mission and what we do here at Mind the Frontline. So let's continue to build these conversations. Let's continue to have these talks. Let's continue to smash the stigma to build a more stronger and resilient first responder community for all of us. Thank you for being a part of the Critical Conversations by Mind the Frontline. Until next time, take care, stay strong, and mind the frontline.
To our dedicated listeners, thank you again for joining us on this critical journey. Remember, the Critical Conversations podcast is a steadfast resource for police, fire, EMS, allied healthcare workers, dispatchers, air medical, and military personnel, along with their families. Your support makes the impact of these conversations resonate even further. If you found today's discussion enlightening and want to stay connected with our ongoing mission, please be sure to subscribe to the Critical Conversations podcast. You can find us via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the Mind the Frontline website. Your subscription ensures that you will never miss an episode, and it's a powerful way to show your commitment to fostering resilience within the entire first responder community. For more information and additional resources, visit our website at www.mindthefrontline.org. Together, let's continue these critical conversations and build a stronger, more resilient first responder family. We thank you for being a part of the Critical Conversations podcast. Until next time, take care, stay strong, and mind the front line.